So, Bill, the title of today's program, The Language of Pseudoscience.
Or Pseudoscience, as we say in Mississippi.
For those that wear leisure suits,
yes,
absolutely.
Right, yeah.
But I didn't even know it had its own language. Our guest today is Bob Blaskowitz, a Britton Fellow at the Georgia Tech School of Literature, Communication, and Culture. Does it have its own language, or did I just pick a bad title?
No, I mean, it has its own use of everyday language in scientific language, so...
Okay, and is this sort of mix and match science and regular language to create obfuscation? I just wanted to use that word.
In fact, I was planning to use the word obfuscatory, so...
Sweet!
Yeah, we're totally on the same level here. But what was the question?
All right. Well, we're gonna the question was, can we use obfuscus?
We're going to enter the mind of Bob Blaskowitz like nobody
this
else
is gonna
can.
And can I pronounce obfuscatory?
Yeah.
Next up on Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.
Been feeling your traditional American values are under attack by pop country? Well, we've got your vixens.
That just makes me feel right at home again.
If you want to feel even more at home, tune in every Sunday night from 9 to 10 p.m. for the Back Alley Pork Roost right here on WRK Atlanta 91.1 FM.
If you like country, folk, bluegrass, and American traditional, tune in to the Back Alley Pork Roost every Sunday night, 9 to 10 p.m.
For lots of old-timer songs about things like boll weevils, the Great Depression, shipwrecks, train wrecks, drownings, the Civil War, sharecropping, coal mining, and jug bands.
That's 9 to 10 p.m. Sundays right here at WRK Atlanta.
The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology. Welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science, only funnier. I'm Pete Ludovis, and as always, I'm joined by my ever-effervescent co-host, a man who believes Darwin's black box is a humidor filled with Honduran cigars, Bill Hunt.
Thank you.
Are you a big fan of Honduran cigars?
The Darwinium ones, yeah.
Ooh, they have those?
Right, well, they're bigger and more
they're highly
flavorful.
Evolved
they're highly
cigars.
Highly evolved cigars. Yeah.
And actually, that's a reference to Dr. Bakey's book about irreproducible...
About cigars?
irreproducible complexity.
Okay.
He called it Darwin's black box.
Okay.
And it's an example of something that I don't think is good science, but I will say it probably is science. He is, you know, a technical person, a biologist.
Right.
But we're going to be
talking
about...
He's actually a chemist. He's a biochemist.
Is he a chemist?
Yeah, he's not... He's... my understanding is that... his department, he works at Lehigh University.
Yeah, he's from Lehigh.
And he's in the biology department after they... my understanding is that the two departments kind of like Borg, you know.
Oh, yeah. They merge departments all the time.
And he had tenure. And they have a disclaimer on their website saying that the biology department in no way agrees with this, that they don't think that it's science.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah.
Okay. Well, there you go.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the point is the attempt is made to put it within the systematic constructs of the rigor of science. Mm-hmm. You may think it's bad science, but bad science is very different than what I think is even a more egregious thing, and it's more common, is pseudoscience. And that's what we're here to talk about today, the language of pseudoscience. And chiming in there before is our guest, Bob Blaskowitz, who is a Britton Fellow with the Georgia Tech School of Literature, Communication, and Culture. He did his PhD at St. Louis University in English and works in the fields of American literature and composition.
Yep.
Okay. And now here's an interesting note. You are also on the board of the Independent Investigations Group Atlanta, which investigates extraordinary claims and offers a $50,000 prize for anyone who could provide evidence for the existence of the occult, supernatural, or a paranormal under properly controlled conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And he writes and co-edits for, is it skepticalhumanities.com? Okay, we'll make sure and get a link to that so people that are interested.
Would this include verified Elvis sightings?
Sure. I guess as history, okay. I guess it counts as humanities.
I'll be working on that.
Yeah, I always thought Bill himself was just a proof of the occult, his mere existence.
Yeah, something went wrong someplace, right.
So, I mean, so you're into English and writing and composition.
Yep.
How did you get involved in this sort of pseudoscience stuff?
Well, I've always been kind of a fan of science. You know, when I was in high school, I was big into amateur astronomy, so I'm kind of familiar with certain topics in science. But when I was doing my dissertation, I did my dissertation on the fiction and memoirs of World War II combat veterans. That naturally led to an interest in pseudoscience.
I mean, that's interesting. So are you specific authors? The famous ones that came out of that. James Jones, for example.
Yeah, there was an entire chapter on James Jones. Right, and one of the things I talked about was memory. And in literary theory, there is an entire field of study called trauma studies. And I found that what the people in my field were saying did not line up with what we've learned since Freud. Mm-hmm. I actually had to go in and look at how memory works and what the current model of memory is, and maybe that would help us understand this literature a little bit better.
Oh, okay.
And that's kind of how I got into actually researching the stuff.
So. And how were they sort of distorting the theory of trauma and memory?
Well, in just about every way you can think of. So, the first thing is that they're still sticking to a Freudian model as if it's still applied to how the mind works. The Freudian model has long since been disproved. It hadn't taken into account the way in which we found that memory is malleable and changes. In fact, there doesn't seem to be something that we call suppression or repression.
One of those S words.
We can't, conjure lost memories and retrieve them like they're objects.
Mm-hmm.
They're, in fact, always in the process of being reconstructed.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that, not only authors but entire cultures could have repressed memories. They're taking an inadequate model of the human mind, then using that as a metaphor for society, and then mistaking the metaphor for the real thing. And it's just this, a big problem that, as far as I can tell, it allows you to say, and Freud is great, and this is why I think English majors love Freud, is because he lets you say that A equals B, and so you can interpret anything to mean just about anything you like. That's not rigorous.
Yeah, and despite the fact that there are some useful ideas that psychologists and psychiatrists get from psychotherapy that came out of Freud's thinking, Freud himself was really an atrocious scientist, and the best description of that for the layman, I think, is in a book called Yes, We Have No Neutrinos, and unfortunately I forget the name of that. I'm going to look that up over the break, that talks about everything from, cold fusion to, some of these theories that use statistics to what Freud basically did.
Mm-hmm.
So actually what you're bringing up is something kind of interesting, and I believe it has a name, and I always forget the name it is. It's this whole idea that Sokol picks on.
Right.
The fact that scientists are crazy enough to believe that there is a fundamental truth, right? This is how it is. Now, how it is may have a huge error bar on it.
Mm-hmm.
How it is may be complicated by lots of different factors, and that certainly happens in biology. But basically, when the ligand binds with the receptor, it does this 99% of the time, and that leads to this. Now, that's complicated by these 87 factors, and it varies depending on your body mass index and who you are and what your age is. But there's one thing. There's no relativism.
Right.
Is there a name for this theory that a lot of the non-scientific folks likes to say that, one theory is as good as another, and we could just argue their relative
merits. Relativism.
Relativism. Yeah. Okay. There it is. The big word, relativism. And is this what Sokol was talking about?
Pretty close. Although he was talking more specifically, Alan Sokol, as you, you're familiar with his story.
Yeah, but you might want to tell our listeners a little about this hoax and Alan Sokol.
Is a physicist. I forget where he works. I believe somewhere in New York.
Yep.
At university.
It's either NYU or CUNY or something like that.
Yeah.
One of those unis.
Yeah. And
not the sushi, though. That's kind of bitter. Sorry.
Bazing. And so, he'd read this book by Gross and Levitt called Higher Superstition, and the academic left in its quarrels with science. And he thought that this was rather provocative. He wanted to see if by parroting the language of kind of politically motivated literary theory, by name-dropping, misusing scientific language, if he could get published in a respectable journal.
Right, right.
And it turned out he wrote this screamer, the hermeneutics of quantum gravity or something like that.
Yeah, so whenever you use quantum, that's got to impress people.
That's a, yeah. And so it was published in the journal Social Text, and at about the same time he came out in another magazine that saying this was complete bollocks from beginning to end, and look, they actually published it.
Right.
And
right.
So he was – what he was pointing to was that some of the big names in literary theory – and literary theory kind of expands into cultural theory, and they're all interconnected. And that's a problem because they don't really define what they're supposed to be studying. But that they kind of – well, they crib the legitimacy of scientific language for their own political ends, and in fact may not understand what they're talking about at all. So it's in the context of relativism. Yeah.
Okay, and you know, this isn't something that's unique to what Sokol did. I mean, the guys from MIT and other places are always making some random, you know, word generator that generates some abstract that they submit. And we will say this, that one of the nice things about true science is that it is peer-reviewed. If it comes out in the Journal of Physical Chemistry, or even the International Journal of Humor Research, it's actually peer reviewed, and they got some heavy duty stuff in there.
Were the checks things like not funny?
You know, no, stuff actually, like that. Nothing in the journal Humor is funny. It's not funny at all.
So would you
it's
have
a
like
an
article on the history of the rubber duck and how that evolved?
No.
From
it's
the
all
wooden
about
duck
you
that
know
floated in the bathtub and eventually then it could squeak. And
yeah, no,
I wrote.
All,
I wrote that
it's
paper,
all
actually.
Chicken crossing the road actually. Jokes in higher education. I mean, it's
stapled
boring.
To the punk rock
right.
and things like that.
But the point is, none of that is perfect. It is very fallible because it's based on two or three people reading the paper and saying yes. This is okay. Yeah. They make mistakes. They're not perfect. And let's face it, even scientists, we're impressed by pedigree. Someone's like, well, this guy must be good, you know. And so things slip by. But when something is just gibberish from beginning to end, that's supposed to be caught, right?
Yeah.
And
not always is caught. You know, there have been
some of these MIT abstracts have ended up in conferences.
Well, a couple of things that, you know, we should clarify. And so science is from the Greek or Latin scientia, meaning to know.
Mm-hmm.
So at its root, science is about knowing, and knowing's a lot more than just what are the statistics or whatever, but it's knowing it inside and out is the way I think of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when we're putting an umbrella on this thing, and we're going to focus in the show on things that are in the technical arena, it's the idea that if science gets done properly, I mean, I don't know, what do we characterize that as? No, you're going to have to make some assumptions, but you make reasonable. I mean, how do you
adjust for evidence? I mean, science seems to, you know, nothing is sacred. Everything is a little bit tentative,
agreed.
And even if we know with a high degree of confidence, a very high degree of confidence that, evolution by means of natural selection is an actual thing, if we do find that. I guess the famous example is a rabbit in the Precambrian, you know, something that just can't be explained by our model. The model will have to change. You know,
right. Nothing is sacred.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's kind of these pseudosciences don't seem to, well, they don't seem to change very often, or if they do, it's in a very ad hoc sort of way.
But right. You sort of have a theory, and that's what's sacred to you, and you defend that no matter what.
Well, but I think, you know, to be fair and totally unbiased, we see that in science. I mean, there's a certain level of...
Yeah, we like to defend our theories.
All my friends look around and, yeah, everybody's going with this godless evolution thing. Yeah,
but every once in a while, you got to suck it up and change.
But what I'm saying is that don't think... I don't subscribe to there being a, you know, good guy, bad guy thing. If you want to look at the extreme of somebody that's maliciously or purposefully idiotic... When I was over in Birmingham on Sunday and driving back and getting AM radio stations late night, try to keep me awake, and somebody's on this thing about Obama's birth certificate. And I'm going, you know, and I start looking stuff up. You can see his birth certificate online. His mother was an American.
And here's the answer.
Show
me a Kenyan birth certificate Nigeria, Malaysia, where it's supposed to come from.
The problem is this person, you know, is really just a shrill for the Republican Party, and he's going on and on and on. He's not adjusting his point of view in an unbiased manner.
Right.
That's data comes in, and you want to evaluate that in the most unbiased manner possible, you know, and that's an example. It's political where you just go, well, this guy has a point of view, and, you know, it's, as a friend of mine used to say, after you argue with an idiot long enough, you begin to wonder who the idiot is. I mean, they're not going to change their point of view,
right.
So...
Well, I think what we're looking at, you know, science, you know, champions itself on having conclusions that are derived from evidence, whereas in the pseudosciences, you might see the opposite, that evidence is picked based on the conclusion you want to get to.
Exactly.
So, when it comes to conspiracy theories, that's another thing that I'm all over.
Okay.
When it comes to the birthers, you know, they have their own, when it comes to any conspiracy theorist, they have their own experts, they have their own evidence. I'm sometimes tempted to group in within, you know, kind of the knowledge of science, conspiracy theories and alternate kind of faux history as being in much the way that a pseudoscience is a kind of a parody of science, that, you know, conspiracy theory is a parody of history. And history is you build up models based on evidence.
Right.
So they're very similar and they function in many the same ways.
But the point is, if you take a truly scientific view, as soon as someone shows you a African or Malaysian birth certificate or you have evidence that things were tampered with, I'm happy to believe.
Well,
you know. But there is, I don't see any of that.
After you make sure that the person doesn't have a history of forgery, and you have to.
Exactly.
The extraordinariness of the claim, this is Carl Sagan, who always says, the extraordinary claim requires extraordinary evidence. It's not up to me to debunk every UFO sighting.
Okay.
It's up to the person who is making the claim that UFOs are piloted by green people.
Yeah, we got
to
take a break. This guy was making the point was, you know, why Obama's not coming forward? We got way bigger problems.
I don't think he has to come forward.
No, I don't think he does either. But this guy is acting like, well, there must be something here because he's not coming forward against all these people who are doing it. It's like, I hope he...
So we're going to take a quick break here. But when we come back, what I want to examine is something motivated by one of Carl Sagan's quotes from his last book, Demon-Hunted World, Science as a Candle in the Darkness. He claimed that most Americans can't tell the difference between science and pseudoscience. So when we come back, let's look at how one might actually do that. So after this break, we'll be right back on Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.
If you know the symptoms, then get the facts. You'll know the signs of a heart attack. Women, listen to me, and when I'm done, if it sounds familiar, call 911.
Pain in your neck, chest,
arms, or jaw,
shortness of breath,
please tell us more. Cold sweats and nausea, tiredness,
it's time to take it
serious. Back pain, stomach pain, shortness of breath, cold sweats, nausea, dizziness. If you know the symptoms and heed the signs, you'll be around for a long, long time. Women, listen to me, and when I'm done, if any sound familiar, call 911.
Learn a song that could save your life. Get a free download at womenshealth.gov/heartattack.
Women, listen to me, and when I'm done, if any sound familiar, call 911. If any sound familiar, call 911.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
911.
We'll be right back. all the best and craziest electronic music, tune in every Wednesday evening here on WRAK Atlanta from 7 to 9 p.m. to the movies.
Join your host, Matt and Josh, on a space ride through future fun, from industrial to IDM, from noisecore to bit rock, dub, ambient, and everything in between.
We feature in-studio sets, live interviews, and recorded mixes from the finest in local, national, and international electronic music.
Focus on everything from labels such as Warp, Schematic, Merc, and all sorts of net labels to suit your synth fancy.
It's every Wednesday from 7 to 9 p.m. All your electronic music needs, the Mobius here on WREK.
The home of true quality diverse music.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where our guest is Bob Blazkowicz, a Britton Fellow with the Georgia Tech School of Literature, Communication, and Culture, who's talking with us about pseudoscience. Mm-hmm. And if you're listening to us live Wednesdays, noon to 1 Eastern Time, and have a question or comment about this fascinating topic, give us a call here at the studio at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. And before the break, we postulated... or at least we talked about Carl Sagan's claim that most Americans can't tell science from pseudoscience. Mm-hmm. First of all, do you think that's true? I actually do think that's true.
I think his statement is pseudoscience because he doesn't have any data to back it up.
Yeah. There's information that...
No, but I don't... somebody makes that statement, or any kind of statement, yeah, I think most people do this, most people do that.
The folks
they haven't
at
looked
Pew
they haven't
and other places have
it.
Done a lot of the... Just watch jaywalking on the Tonight Show, and you're going to see examples of that.
Well, but that's a different... That's not then
that is edited and selected and is not a representative sample.
Yeah, it's not scientific either.
But I do think that there are some problems, the way in which certain words get kind of flung around in the media, words like quantum, and you just say quantum and apparently anything is possible. You know, you have people who do not understand, and there's occasional polls too that are released that show major deficiencies in American understanding of science.
Right,
and it's important because we are a technologically advanced country capable of doing big things. Certainly a lot of the coverage of the disaster in Japan would be much less sensationalistic if people had an understanding of how radiation worked.
Same with Three Mile Island, which was a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, like 30 years ago, yeah.
So let's take an example, and I'm going to pick on my favorite one, is the overuse of the word calculus. Right? Okay. Calculus, they now use the term calculus to me. The calculus of the economy, the calculus of the politics of Congress. I don't think most of these people that use calculus have ever taken calculus. It just bothers me.
Well, you use the word calculus.
All right. Trent, our engineer, who's a discrete math major, I'm sure is going to.
I think that's a correct use of the term, though, because you have like propositional calculus and other kind of calculus that don't just involve derivatives and stuff.
Like, so what is propositional calculus? Sounds like you're trying to meet a derivative in a bar.
It's kind of stuff like computer science and discrete math. Like there's like propositional logic and that kind of stuff.
Okay.
And like there's other types of calculus besides
the
standard differential.
But is it really... I might get a good example.
It depends on who you're asking. Like if you're asking like an engineer, calculus is the differential calculus. Like, but mathematicians sometimes use the word just to mean like anything that's...
Right, and if a philosophy logic person uses it, I'll believe it too, but I don't believe most of Congress uses it correctly. Mm-hmm. That's just me.
I was just saying, that's where the trend came from. I don't know if it's like...
So then, Bob, is it fair to say that, mixing science terms in not quite the right usage in with sort of social commentary, is that an example of pseudoscience?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, it's appropriation of the authority of science, and it comes out as some sort of science word salad.
Ah, okay, and that just impresses people.
Yeah.
Because they don't really know what quantum means, so that, it's got big words in it, it must be important. Yeah, I think everyone's a victim of that every once in a while.
Yeah.
I mean, part of, what needs to be improved, I'll shy away from saying I know what the problem is, since I haven't done any research either, but is, kind of encouraging people to do their own thinking, even if it's wrong. I think part of what I see on the political arena and these other things is somebody seems authoritative, has a book.
I see what you're saying. And I see why Bob's cringing too.
So I'm not gonna actually look into it myself. I'm gonna trust this guy with two extra eye teeth to tell me where the aliens really did come here.
And this is one of the interesting things about the extraordinary claims of the type that Carl Sagan is talking about is that so often they are believed and believed very strongly. And you know, this is how this works into my classes is like, what are the persuasive strategies that are being used to make people accept bunk?
So what are those strategies?
Well, the first one that we've been talking about is the application of misapplication of scientific terms.
So big word salad. I like that. I'm going to be using that from now on.
Yeah. There are in many cases you can take Answers in Genesis. The people who run the Creation Museum, they have invented their own publishing stream for their stuff, and so they say it's peer reviewed, but it doesn't count if your peers are idiots. You know, I mean, it's,
or if your peers are, like you said, searching for evidence to back up a theory rather than adopting their theory to fit the evidence.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there was actually another example of that. Journal.
Hold on. It would still be if it's reviewed by anybody, it would be considered peer review.
Well, when you look at the Answers Research Journal's review process, which they post on their website, they have this upon the criteria that they include, does this scientific paper provide evidence of faithfulness to the grammatical historical normative interpretation of Scripture? I mean, I don't even know how can we even pretend that's science at that point?
So the Journal of Chemical Physics doesn't say, does this adhere to the theory of rotational isomeric states for polymer conformations?
My point was it's peer-reviewed because these are your peers and they have reviewed it. Does that mean it's infallible? No, the thing you pointed out with ain't a good review process.
But I think what Bob's saying, and he's expanding our definition of the peer-reviewed process, that it is peer-reviewed in an unbiased fashion.
Okay, we'll add that.
They have alternate experts.
They have somebody else look at it, but it's, you know, if the criterion is, does this fit with what we all believe up front, independent of whether or not there's any evidence there, that's... It's peer-reviewed,
other thing is that, you know, the people who publish in their peer-reviewed studies can't publish in mainstream peer-reviewed studies. They often don't, at least not their pet thing is. There are some people who have long histories of doing good science, but then they have this one thing that, you know, like vitamin C and Pauling, you know, like that just doesn't make sense and just doesn't hold up. In some ways, that's they're banking on their appeal to authority.
But the nice thing about Pauling, and you're right, Pauling won the Nobel Prize twice in two different fields, and you know, so he's the dude. Mm-hmm. He is the dude. It's like the big was the big Lebowski. He's the dude.
Right.
And I actually
also like what he said when Shockley was trying to put together a Nobel Prize winner sperm bank. This was in Time magazine, and they asked him to comment, and he said he would only participate if he were allowed to supply the sample personally.
So the guy's got to say, but let's face it, Feynman wrote books about how to meet girls in bars. I mean, Feynman was brilliant, and he had a sense of humor as well. Mm-hmm. But the point about Pauling is, there's a philosophy book that begins by illustrating a classic fallacy that Pauling talks about vitamin C and its impact on cancer cells. And they say, well, this is a fallacy because he's a chemist. He's not really a biologist or an oncologist. He was one of those brilliant chemists of his generation. And by the way, he got his master's degree in chemical engineering. I won't mind you that. The point is that Pauling was right. He just wasn't complete. We now look at the HPV virus, which we talked with Mike Thien about.
I don't understand what so you're saying he shouldn't have won the Nobel Prize? What was he not right about?
Later he said that vitamin C is the key to curing cancer. And that's a gross oversimplification what he said. But really what he started was the connection between the immune system and cancer. And we now know that to be a very important link. Mm-hmm. He just didn't have the complete picture. We now know the human papillomavirus. We talked about this with Mike Thien from Merck the other week, that there are viral things that are connected to cancer, right? Mm-hmm. Mark Prausnitz, right here on our campus, just got a big grant to look at transdermal drug delivery of vaccines. And it's not just that, oh, it's convenient, you don't have to take a shot. Well, that's part of it, because my daughter hates shots. But it's also that when you get it in this space in the top of the skin, the reaction to the immune response is much different. You have this sort of shock tissue layer. You have these immature T lymphocytes, Langerhans cells that respond very differently when it goes under the skin. And by the way, that's when they give you, that's why they give you scratch tests and intradermal tests under the skin, because it's a really good response. So we now understand that Pauling was right. It was just incomplete. But he can get away with saying that stuff because he won the Nobel Prize twice.
And what you see kind of Behe would be an example of this, of somebody who has science chops, but not in the field in which they're publishing.
And Nobel laureates speak out beyond what they do all the time.
That's
Harry
fine.
Croteau mentioned that when he was on the show. And that's okay.
Did the caller...
Oh, I guess they had a semi question of, was stem cell research like an example of something that was based on science, but then there's a lot of kind of pseudoscience related to it from science fiction or just people having odd opinions or...
Ooh, that's a good question. So stem cell research is clearly science, right?
Right. Oh, stem cell research is unquestionably science.
But you might know, is there a lot of pseudoscience out there about it?
I guess you could talk about the Raelians, the people who said that they're creating their own clones. They're kind of a religious group. They're a bunch of, nudists, who are very excited about, you know, the advent of genetic technologies, and they claim that
and you can tell they're really excited.
Yeah.
I'm not a prude. I'm just against nudist colonies for two reasons. One, sticking to the furniture in the summer and accidentally slamming your junk in the refrigerator door. It's a practical thing, because I'm an applied scientist. Yes, right.
The important thing is that this is a legitimate policy issue that we should be debating at the national level.
Yeah.
And everyone seems to have an opinion about it, but you ask someone to define what is a stem cell, and they probably won't be able to do it very well.
And actually, one of the 12 questions by one of the Pew Research Foundation polls was, what is a stem cell? And the answer is, you know, one that can diversify into other types of tissue. Very simple answer. And there are a lot of people that did not get that question right, which is kind of sad.
Let me ask this. I mean, I think we're still...
All right, wait, did we answer the question? The question is, and I believe Todd McDevitt, who was on our program a while ago talking about this, would agree. It is clearly science. But I don't think people are specifically trying to create pseudoscience. Well, actually, maybe
but
they
there's
are.
There's some pseudoscience that helps policy go.
There is.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that is a big problem. And one of the problems I know Todd has is there are a lot of people who think, oh, you're playing God. This is horrible. And I have to say this. We got about 6-7 questions when he was on the program. They were all very intelligent, erudite questions. None of them were based on pseudoscience. Mm-hmm. So,
well, I mean, I think, you know, there are a couple of things that I'm, you know, wrestling with here. I mean, the term pseudoscience has a connotation of whacked out, no data really, totally, like the Alien Festival in Roswell, New Mexico, which I hope to go to again. That was just awesome.
But see, I would call creationism and intelligent design pseudoscience, plain and simple. I'm going on a limb. I'm calling it that. Would you agree or disagree, Bob?
I absolutely agree.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, I would have to read all the stuff in there. I also...
Bob said, they've got the burden of proof to show me some carbon dating or isotopic redistribution of a dinosaur bone next to a human bone to justify putting a saddle on a dinosaur in the Creation Museum.
Well, I think Dawkins...
There's that.
I don't think I could have said it more succinctly.
Yeah, it was the Dawkins wrote the God...
Delusion,
I think he's an idiot, but...
But that's not a book about science, though. I think that's a book about philosophy and spirituality. He doesn't present any evidence.
Well, you know, I think that his atheism is certainly informed by his view of biological evolution.
Okay.
He makes the assertion that the origin of the universe is a scientific question.
He ain't taking any new data either. But I guess my point with the pseudoscience is, what do you really mean by it? Because, for example, there have been numerous examples where somebody does some science and then buries the data that they don't want to see, one of which, interestingly, is when in 1918 or 1919, where there was this passage of a star near the sun during an eclipse, and they had sent one team to the coast of Brazil, one to the coast of Africa to look at it. If the light was bending around the sun to look at it.
Which is proof of relativity.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And in one of those experiments, it looked like it bent, and the other one it didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy threw out the data, the one that didn't, big
right.
announcement.
That's fraud.
Einstein
I mean,
is right.
Yeah, that is fraud. The NSF would
is.
Define that as the National Science Foundation would say the same thing.
So that's fraud, and there are lots of examples of that.
Mm-hmm.
One of the Nobel Prizes went to the guy that came up with the lobotomy, and he sat on a lot of data about what was really going on with lobotomy. So is that... Mm-hmm. So you're saying those things are fraudulent,
No, that would be pseudoscience. If it's borrowing scienciness where it doesn't apply and faking your data, I would put that under pseudoscience as well.
Well, I think the biggest...
Or just lying.
Yeah. I think to me, the most... Let me put it this way. That the most harm is done by this thing called pseudoscience is when it creeps into legislation and decisions are made, mm-hmm. policy decisions right. are made based on puffs of smoke, that it's not really anything there. And how do you sort that? How do you sort that out from we really just don't know yet, and we're trying string theory,
like
we're trying
with
this
climate
other thing,
change.
And
no,
yet
sure.
I'm
yeah, right.
I'm going to sit here and I'm taking my stance with this community. The
yeah.
string theory
climate
is
change,
the deal,
there's a lot of uncertainty.
And it may turn out that I'm wrong.
And that was a couple months ago. We did
but there's
show.
Lots of my understanding.
With,
is
Judy
that,
Curry, actually.
That there's uncertainty, but that, not that climate change is occurring. I mean,
but like, exactly how it's occurring and at what
to
rate.
To what degree
and, yes.
man is involved.
Yes, right. That's the question.
Anthropogenic. Mm-hmm. And that's true, but some people say that, you know, that it's a ruse in order to get dramatic, you know, to invoke a carbon tax and impose that on people, and that's
I don't
wild
think anybody
speculation.
Really wants to do that,
yeah.
though, right? We yeah.
But you know.
Well, I mean, I think that's a case where, I don't know if you would call it pseudoscience, but I mean, I think the jury is really still out on whether or not, you know, sequestering CO2 makes any sense at all in terms of what we're saying,
right? But
yeah, that's
but
a practical
it,
judgment.
But
yeah.
one of the things that we do have models and predictive models of what, let's say, Venus should look like, and that's a planet that has gone a runaway greenhouse effect. We know that certain gases, when they're released,
yes,
are greenhouse
absolutely.
Gases, and this is no longer, as far as I can tell, this is no longer an issue in the scientific community that global warming is something that needs to be taken seriously.
Yeah. I mean, not only the gases, but simply the density of the atmosphere goes proportional with how much heat it's trapping.
I guess my point would be, you know, it still should be studied more. I don't think you ought to be throwing.
Well, but no one's saying we shouldn't study it.
Oh yeah. And
I'm not saying we shouldn't study it. What I'm saying is we shouldn't make policy based on incomplete science, which is not the same thing as pseudoscience. But it's like you don't really, really, really have the answer yet, so it's not really time to start doing.
Well, you got to make a policy that takes into account that uncertainty
or that is flexible.
That was Judy Curry's point.
Mm-hmm.
Were
right.
you here for that? Or were you...
Yeah, I was here.
Okay.
The one thing that you hear is go, well, 30 years ago, they're worried about global cooling, but now they're worried about global warming. How can we trust them? Well, you know, science gets better. They
yes.
change their assertions based on the evidence. So
yeah, and there was actually
that's a strength.
Yeah. In 1978, there was this big ice storm that hit the East Coast. The front cover of Time magazine showed the World Trade Tower with a glacier pushing between an artist's rendition of mm-hmm. this. And we were on the verge of the next ice age. So I guess the point is that I would look at that in a broad sense and say, you know, it's great for these people to predict things and climatologists and study it, but I don't know is probably the best thing they could say.
That's something that we need to let people know, is that I don't know is a respectable answer.
Right.
And
perfectly
sometimes
respectful.
It's and sometimes
it
it's
accurate.
Unfortunately, you can't sway, you know, people to make public policy based on we don't know yet.
Well, we had numerous examples of that. We interviewed Chris Mooney about his book, mm-hmm. Unscientific America, and how he pointed his co-author who worked with Congress said scientists get their butts kicked when they go in there with the, here's what we think, we're never 100% sure, right? Rob mm-hmm. Butera, who was on the Hill mm-hmm. As a Jefferson fellow,
right.
said some very similar things that we don't have the complete answer. And your whole climate change gets even more complicated by the fact that if we ever get Thanos Nennis from Earth and Atmospheric Sciences on here, he's going to point out that whatever greenhouse effect we have is probably worse than it is, because all the particulates in the air create extra cloud cover and cool it. So it's very complicated. But to that end, what I'd like you to do, Bill, is after the break, let Bob get a couple of examples of pseudoscience.
Let him actually talk.
When we come back from the break. And after those, if you're still listening, ladies and gentlemen, listening to us live Wednesday, noon to 1 East Coast time, and you've got a question or comment, give us a call here at the studio at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. We'll be right back with Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.
Asian music.
The best.
Mondays from 6 to 7 p.m. Join us for 50 Pounds of Rice with your hosts, Jay Walker and Winter.
So if you're interested, turn your dial to 91.1 and listen to the best Asian music this side of the Yangtze River.
Listen to The Longboard Show, playing 50 years of surf and instrumental rock every Tuesday at 9 p.m. on WREK.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking with Bob Blaskowitz about pseudoscience. Mm-hmm. So maybe we should take a look at a few examples of pseudoscience.
Right. I think that the classic pseudoscience, honestly, is ghost hunting, where people go into abandoned houses in the dark, scare themselves, and come to decision whether or not a location is haunted. They describe themselves as scientists. They're taking readings. They are using scientific equipment, but what they're doing is not science. It's not controlled. It's not.
What are the so I've I whiz by these when I'm using the clicker on the TV, and I'm like, you see them. They're always lit with green. Is that their infrared lights or something?
Yeah.
And they're all
night vision. That's night vision.
What do they take? What measurements do they take?
Well, it depends. I mean, sometimes you can have...
Didn't you see Ghostbusters? It was all laid out very clearly.
They use all sorts of stuff. And there is no piece of equipment they can't misuse. They will use electromagnetic field detectors. They will use all sorts of cameras, digital and antique. They'll use... Geiger counters. In fact, I have I brought a clip of an explanation of how a Geiger counter works from a ghost hunter. This was from the Ghost Hunters show.
With the Geiger?
Geiger, yep.
Homemade infrared illuminator that Mike made. This will send out the infrared beam so you don't have to have a night vision.
They're introducing
camera.
The...
It's got a Geiger counter here somewhere. About it. Don't know what it does. Well, I know it does, at least I know it's measured.
Come to my lecture and I'll tell you.
Why don't you explain this to me, Mr. Show Me Your Lecture?
All right.
See, it's a Geiger counter.
It's actually made up to actually scent radioactive material.
Okay.
That's the way Geiger counters are.
Okay.
First off, you zeroize it.
Zeroize?
Zeroize? Zeroize? That's what I call it.
Zeroize?
Zero.
And then he's right here. Yeah, this is just like an EMF detector. 100, the 10, the 1, and the 0, the 0.1.
What does that mean?
100, it's actually almost like Milligauss, but it's not. I forgot the word for it. But it's based, Milligauss based there. Who's he got here?
It goes up to 11.
Actually, I don't know who made it.
Well, it's better than 10, man. It's 11.
It's based off of this. So, it's...
I really didn't get an explanation there.
I'm trying to explain it to you, and you're not even...
You just went through the same thing anybody looking at it could have went through.
You're such an ass.
But what you have here is that, like, you know, scientists understand the equipment. They understand what it does, and it works because they understand what it's supposed to do. With, you know, if you're going through with a Geiger counter, you're going to be detecting, you know, particles, stuff, not
some
ghosts.
Some kind of ionizing radiation that could, I'm not sure, does Geiger count pure gamma rays, or does it also count the particle version of ionizing?
I think it depends on the type, I think.
Okay.
So,
but the point is, you could make a device that would do alpha particles, beta particles, gamma rays.
The general
gamma
thing
rays
for the Geiger counter is it's actually a vacuum tube.
Yeah, the Geiger-Müller tube.
And if a particle, whether it's a photon, which would be a gamma ray, or a beta ray, which is an electron
or an alpha particle, which is a helium nucleus.
If they can get into it, so if they haven't been absorbed elsewhere, it can ionize the gas that's in the vacuum tube, and then you get a lot of current in that avalanche kind of effect. That's how the thing works. So if the stuff gets in there, you hear the... You know,
or if a ghost gets in there.
Like but I think what's more is not... I mean, a lot of people can use equipment correctly, but what's more important is for you to understand when you're getting the noise, the background radiation. So, for example, fluorescence is an easy way to detect if biological things are around. But the problem is, I remember doing some work on transdermal drug delivery, and just your skin, biological samples leak off a lot of green fluorescing things that show up, and you think, oh, well, then you have to do a control experiment, right?
When you see... Ghost hunters, and certainly the Ghost Hunter show, in the early seasons, I imagine they finally just, even they got embarrassed. Right. They would go around and they'd look for cold spots. Why a cold spot is
so
supposed to be a
cold in temperature, right?
Right. So they have these digital thermometers, and they point them into the air, and they say, "Look right here. It's you know, 3 degrees cooler. Oh, and here it's." But what they didn't realize is that it's detecting the temperature of the wall. And then they're pointing at the window.
Is underground,
and so it's not a floating. It's not a floating.
It's
cold spot. Yeah, it's and so they were completely misinterpreting what they were seeing.
Well, the other, I mean, I would chime in here too that, you know, I think it's great that people get interested in science and engineering. That's one of the big motivators for me doing this show with Pete, because I really can't stand Pete. I don't know if I've mentioned that.
You've mentioned that several times before. Yeah. Who could blame you, Bill?
But this is not, you know, this is that guy on the clip is trying to sound authoritative when he really doesn't know. To me, if you can't explain it, you don't really know what's going on.
Well,
whether it's the economy or, you know.
It's a matter of also of audience. I wonder if someone who's doing string theory, even the people who are best at it, could explain it to me. You know,
that's a tough one. We've been trying to get Brian Greene on the show to do just that for a long time.
But the
and that's not necessarily pseudoscience. I mean, there's certainly people who think, well, I can't.
No, but it's so complicated.
Pseudoscientists latch onto the fact that even related disciplines have their own vocabularies and have their own specializations. Thomas Kuhn in The Structure of Scientific Revolutions said that this is something you see in a mature science. You see people developing their own vocabularies and their own methods, and as a paradigm comes into being. And so it's not surprising that there are people in the biology department here at Tech who probably don't really speak the same language professionally. So there's that. Some of the other things, the criteria by which they decide whether or not something is evidence of a haunting is completely, as far as I can tell, kind of random and ad hoc. For example, have you ever heard of the EVPs, electro voice phenomenon? So what they do, they have the recorders out, a digital recorder out, and they ask questions or taunt the ghost or whatever, and then they listen to it and they try to determine try to make out voices and stuff in there. Mm-hmm. And you have to use an older digital recorder.
Wait, they're extracting voice somehow mm-hmm. as a response?
Yes, if they can hear a voice responding to a question, or maybe they'll pick up the voice of a little girl or something in the background. And it's actually, they are hearing something, but what's more interesting is that the human mind by itself can make apparent, can perceive patterns in what is genuinely random.
Yeah.
And we do this all the time.
Lots of noise floating around.
And so a good example of this, which is good for radio, is pareidolia. So I have a clip of something that is just random, I think three-tone sinusoidal mm-hmm. something or other. But it is random, so if you could play that first clip.
First clip?
Yep.
Like Hendrix.
Okay, so what's it saying?
I don't know.
Okay, play the second one.
It was a sunny day and the children were going to the park.
Oh, is it digitally filtered?
No, it's not digitally filtered.
Oh, it's just random.
You're making that order. They've suggested it to you, and you hear it. Yeah,
psychologists will talk about us making those patterns. Our mind is designed to make those patterns.
Exactly.
Right. It's an efficiency thing. It's a good thing for your mind.
Mm-hmm.
But we find patterns sometimes that don't exist.
And so they say, well, this is evidence, and they hear this in the fuzzy background noise of audio recordings.
Yeah.
And they hear randomness and hear voices.
Right.
And it's
like Paula's dad on the White Album a couple of
Well, yeah, you play these things back. Yeah, and there's a whole psychology of us trying to put together these patterns. But likewise, say I'm walking through a haunted house with a Geiger Müller tube and I find mm-hmm. a spike in radiation, but it happens to be in a basement an old coal bin.
Uh-huh.
Right. Coal, as Gwyneth Cravens pointed out a few weeks ago on this program, uh-huh. coal has a lot of radioactive stuff in it, and it's a tiny amount, but above background, you might notice it.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the things we're
looking for. So we've got a caller. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Yeah, what you were talking about, the mind forcing patterns, the old thing about watching Billy Graham and playing Pink Floyd in the background, or watching The Wizard of Oz and playing Pink Floyd in the background, your brain actually will make them dance.
Yeah, I believe that.
I have recorded, I've actually copied ballet performances, and I would have that running on one TV over there with the sound off, just so I'd know where it was in it, and listening to music of some other kind, and yep, they dance to whatever you're playing.
All right, so Pink Floyd is good, you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, Pink Floyd is really good.
Okay, so I'm going to put Bill Nye the Science Guy in with Pink Floyd and see what happens.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, it's a good point because there is that level of suggestion. And I mean, I think people do this to some extent anyway, but my mother, who was severely hearing impaired, she could read lips, but she was also anticipating certain things in the conversation. So if you were just dancing all around in your thoughts and jumping to something totally unrelated, she would have a next impossible time communicating with you.
Right.
But if it's in a thread and she could go, he's still talking about the baseball game or whatever, then it's, I mean, I think we are kind of set to contextually evaluate things. Mm-hmm.
But that's a great example.
Actually, think about this now with what you just said. A dial-up line, when it first hits, you get that tone burst.
Mm-hmm.
The dial-up line is actually doing a handshake and saying, "Okay, what speed are we going to talk at?"
Right, right.
So they have to figure that out. Once they figure out how good the line is, now you go at some baud rate, but
it
isn't necessarily, you know, an optimal. It's just whatever we managed to.
That's a good point.
So to
clarify, you know, if you're on a cell phone and you got a bad connection or whatever, you get the information, you slow the speed of data transmission, you get it across, whereas if, you know, it's a bad transmission and you decide to give 15 turns on how to, somebody to get there and, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's too, you won't do it quickly because you know inherently the data is not good. That's a very good point.
And that's
point.
One for the old guys. Mm-hmm. What you're mm-hmm. saying is, I don't even think that people use baud rate anymore. You're talking about the old acoustic couplers where you put the phone in the little rubber cups.
Like
and
organs.
You can actually hear the handshake.
A modem.
That's a great thing. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, great comment.
Excellent.
That's
excellent.
A great metaphor. Thank mm-hmm. you.
Go back and listen sure. to Pink Floyd and...
There's
and Bill Nye the Science.
There's a whole area of study of backmasking, and that's looking at like mm-hmm. reverse speech and messages in albums and mm-hmm. people saying there's even a type of therapy that says what you really mean can be heard when you play the mm-hmm. your speech backwards. You know?
But you know, I mean, the thing
very
is
strange,
that
yeah.
I'm open on the ghost thing, but I mean, I had an experience in the first house I had in Atlanta where 3 or 4 in the morning I'm woken up and, you know, there's an old-time radio playing in the corner. I was living alone, mm-hmm. unmarried, and go in there and go, where, you know, and I go outside. I think it's somebody else. There is no sound outside. And I never told anybody. And a few years later, met my wife, we get married, and, you know, she's going, I heard this radio, old radio playing in the corner. I mean, I hadn't told her any of this,
yes.
and she described exactly what I had
heard. I would be surprised if there – was it the same house?
Yeah.
I would be surprised if there wasn't somebody who was listening to old-time radio in, you know – in the neighborhood. I mean, that's a more reasonable...
Yeah, but I stepped, I stepped outside and heard nothing.
But the question is there some resonance with the baby monitor or some other electronic device?
No baby
device?
Monitor.
Right.
No.
Well, who knows?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but...
No,
that,
all I'm saying... I mean, I'm not saying that's proof. I'm just saying it was... And I'm, you know, I'm just saying that was a pretty odd occurrence.
Were there commercials?
Now, no. It was just... big band kind of stuff in the background mm-hmm. in both cases. But I mean, it was, you know, it was really kind of, I mean, I don't know what that means. I'm not going to go on a speaking mm-hmm. tour, sign autographs as a result of it, but I'd never told us because I would just seem like a
well, then there's probably something you know? There, you know, making that noise, but you know, to
what it was, I don't know. Was it the
yeah,
former
resident?
I mean,
to
jump to the conclusion, it's the former resident or something like that, or Dick Cheney wants his heart back, or something like that.
All right, so we need to wrap up in a bit, but can I squeeze in one more example
no.
of pseudoscience?
No.
And it's pseudoscience, I think, only because Jenny McCarthy, former Playboy model, pushes it, and that's the connection that Wakefield suggested between autism and vaccines.
Yeah, and specifically the MMR vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
There's a cottage industry that has grown around scaring people about the contents of vaccine. One of the interesting and unfortunate distinctions that people don't make regarding vaccines is a difference between a correlation versus causation.
Yeah.
And so you finish the MMR, the measles, mumps, rubella vaccination series at about the same time that you can start noticing deficits in the social behaviors of children. So with like 18 months or something, I'm not exactly sure what
okay,
it is.
That's where you would diagnose
right.
something like autism, Asperger's, something like that.
Where you could start seeing that something is wrong, that they're not keeping pace.
Yeah.
So that's apparent. And when a lot of people, when they suggest that, you know, well, did they have their vaccines? Well, yes, they had their vaccines just around the time that, you know, and it kind of gets retrofitted into, you know.
Right. And they also ate ice cream and they also whatever.
Right. Absolutely. And so Wakefield came out in the late 90s with this paper that said that he'd identified a new syndrome. And even though he didn't say that vaccines caused autism, he made it very clear what the implications were at the press conferences. And it was published in The Lancet, which is a good journal.
Yeah.
There were some problems. He didn't. He said that the problem was with the Tamiflu in the MMR and the combination vaccine. Well, he actually had a patent out on a single, maybe it was mumps or measles, one of the elements. So he had a vested financial interest in scaring people. As a result of his campaign, the vaccination rates in Britain plummeted, and
yeah,
you know,
big scare
and
as a result of
and
that.
He essentially he was when they found that he had faked his data, all of it, anything that seemed confirmatory, was faked.
Right, and that was brought up by, I believe, a Mr. Brian Deere.
Right, a journalist who kept on him for years.
Yeah.
And, you know, what are people supposed to do? We don't know much about autism, but what we do know now, thanks to Andrew Wakefield, is that vaccines don't cause autism.
Right.
That's you know,
Jenny McCartney's got an autistic son, which is why she's so keen on...
No, she doesn't. He got better. You don't get better from autism.
Yeah, you know.
So what did he have? I don't think he was...
Yeah, who knows?
Mildly autistic?
Yeah. No.
He was misdiagnosed?
He was probably misdiagnosed, yeah.
And as you pointed out, there's a lot of conflict of interest about this, drug companies being involved. Even Deere was supposedly approached by the British Medical Journal to sort of debunk this, even though he had started looking at this before that. Mm-hmm. There were associations with GlaxoSmithKline and Merck. And associations don't necessarily mean that you're biased, but it's something we need to keep track of.
You have to be aware of it. Yeah. But, you know, where you expect the vaccine experts to be, where they're making the vaccines. So there are going to be associations naturally.
And that's why these are reported in medical journals. Mm-hmm. So we've reached the end of the program where we attempt to discern what have we learned. And I think what we've learned, if Jenny McCarthy's involved in it, it's pretty much pseudoscience. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that. And I've got nothing against Jenny McCarthy. I think she's a fine human being.
Jenny McCarthy's talking,
I've seen her,
I'm,
you know,
listening.
On TV. I think she's fabulous. No? Okay.
But in any case... I just have to listen. That may be
an issue. But so here's probably one of your best examples of pseudoscience that you sort of do. What did you call it? The big word salad, where you mix technical terms
when you make up some
with
new
non-technical
words,
terms.
Like zeroizing.
Right. You know. Zeroizing. And you can achieve obfuscation. The sad thing about that is sometimes technical terms like quantum and things like that are useful in describing social phenomena. So it's very, very hard to tell.
As metaphors, yes.
Yeah. And another point you made is that one of the ways that we engage in pseudoscience is the misuse of equipment. And the misuse of equipment doesn't occur when there's a big signal-to-noise ratio where you're clearly getting a response. Mm-hmm. It's at the edge of precision. That's where the misuse occurs, and that's ghost-busting. That's an excellent example that you showed before. And we learned something very new that was new to me, that a lot of these pseudoscience folks have their own publishing stream, and they claim it's peer-reviewed, but in fact, it's not unbiasedly peer-reviewed.
Right.
Unbiasedly peer-reviewed means you can send it to just about anybody, you know, that's related to the field, and get, you know, if at least two out of the three opinions say, yes, here's why it's good or here's why it's bad. But if you say, look, you must adhere to this particular theory of scripture or whatever bias you have, then it's not particularly good.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess our definition of pseudoscience versus science is that science will bend a theory in response to evidence, whereas pseudoscience looks for evidence to support a theory.
And I would say the biggest harm is done either when somebody starts giving thousands of dollars to cure their autistic child.
Absolutely.
Or we're making public policy.
Yeah, there is that conflict of interest.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yep.
All right. So, Bob, thank you so much for being on the program.
It was a pleasure.
All right. And if you've got a question or comment about this program or a suggestion for a future show, by all means, send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. Our chief engineer is Trent Altman. Our theme music is performed and composed by Bill and Mary Hunt. And we are a production of the WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology. Please join us next week for Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.